Now, if I were to ask you this evening to tell me everything that you know about the staff of Aaron's that budded, how would you respond? Now, some of you may be thinking to yourself, I don't even know anything about what he's talking about tonight. Others of you may be aware that it was one of the three visible signs that was carried within the Ark of the Covenant itself. The other two, of course, being the tablets of stone upon which was written the law and, of course, the jar of manna. There may be some of you who could tell me that it was the result of a test that by which God confirmed to the nation of Israel the authority of Aaron's priesthood. But do we know the lessons? Are we aware of the relevance that this event holds for us, even though we are centuries removed from the actual event? Well, let's start, first of all, by setting the stage to understand what leads up to this merciful sign in the form of Aaron's staff. So let's begin by looking backwards. You remember, of course, that Israel to this point has spent more than 400 years in the land of Egypt, and that a great deal of that time was spent as slaves under Pharaoh's charge. And by means of God's mighty hand, Israel watched as their Lord destroyed the land of their taskmasters by means of a number of plagues. They had also personally witnessed the destruction of Pharaoh's great army in the Red Sea as the water came back together after they themselves had passed through those waters walking on dry land. They had experienced the provision of God through the manna that came from heaven and the water that sometimes flowed from a rock. And yet, in spite of God's undeniable power and His protection and His provision, there continued to remain this prevailing undercurrent of subversiveness and outright defiance, especially when it came to the authority of Moses and Aaron. In Numbers chapters 13 and 14, one of the narratives that we looked at, the people are brought to the very edge of the promised land, and it is there that 12 men, all of them leaders, are selected and then sent in to spy out the land, which they discover to be a land just as advertised. It is indeed a land that flows with milk and honey. But they see something else as well. They see the size and the strength of the land's inhabitants. They see the thick walls that fortified the cities of Canaan. And so they return to Moses with 10 of those 12 men, declaring Israel's inability to conquer those who are living in the land of Canaan. Only two of the 12 step up and urge the people to trust in what God had promised to them, and that promise was to give them not only the land, but to give them the land's inhabitants into their hands. And yet we find in Numbers 14 that the people grumbled against Moses and Aaron, and they even plan for their return back to Egypt, suggesting that they're going to find another leader who will take them back there. But most importantly, they grumble against God. In Numbers chapter 15, a chapter that we actually did not study, what we find in that chapter is that in spite of their disobedient refusal to heed the messenger, that God remains patient and merciful. He continues to speak truth and insight to them through the avenue of Moses. And in that chapter, he warns them of the dire consequences of deliberate disobedience. And it comes to a point, or a head, if you will, in verse 31, where he says it really is an issue of despising the word of the Lord, a deliberate violation of God's commands. And as the chapter closes, we find two very different and yet similarities in terms of what they are trying to illustrate to us, and that is the priority of obedience. The first comes in the account of a man who violates the Sabbath by picking up sticks, and he is himself put to death, and it answers the question, does God mean what he says? And the answer is yes. And then as the chapter comes to a close, there is instruction about attaching tassels to the Jews' everyday garments, and those tassels were to remind them of the need for their continuing commitment to obey God's commands. The common denominator is that they illustrated to Israel the right and the wrong approach to divine authority? Whose voice are they going to listen to? Who are they going to put their trust in? And then a number of the narratives that we did look at was in chapter 16. An account of rebellion against divine authority in spite of what they were told in chapter 15. Especially here in terms of rebelling against God's delegated representatives and spokesmen. And much like the account of the spies, it began with a very small number. One, in fact, a man by the name of Korah. And that number spread to include three others and eventually 250 others. And eventually, there's that air of rebellion that spreads to almost the entire nation. Korah is a man who is basically saying, you know what, I can do what Moses and Aaron can do. I'm holy like them, and therefore I can do what they can do. And he understood that they were not self-appointed leaders, yet they refused to submit to God's will on the matter. They claim that all Israel is holy, which is right, but he wrongly applies that truth to himself. Where Korah's complaint seems to be specifically against Aaron and his exclusive priesthood, Dathan and Abiram, a couple of his cohorts, they direct their complaint, it seems, more against Moses. They accuse him of abject failure, of rigid authoritarianism, of breaking his promises and deceiving them in terms of what lay ahead of them. And so on the very next day in that chapter, we find that the entire congregation is gathered together to witness God's judgment on the matter. And when the dust all settles, the earth is opened, it is swallowed up, the four ringleaders, fire from heaven has fallen and consumed 250 of their immediate supporters. And though initially when those events occur, the people are fearful that the ground will swallow them up as well, on the very next day in chapter 16 and verse 41, they boldly assemble against Moses and Aaron to accuse them of having killed those hundreds of men. In the midst of their rebellion, God sends a plague that claims the lives of almost 15,000 people, and it is only the quick instruction of Moses and the swift intercession of Aaron that stops the continuing spread of judgment. And in the process, rather than Aaron's leadership and intercession being shown to be a cause of death, it is instead shown to be the provision or for the preservation of life. God has powerfully validated Aaron's position and his authority in the process. Now, we might think, okay, that's where the story would end, that the rebellion is stopped, the murmuring is silenced. But what we see here in Numbers chapter 17 is that God himself takes an additional step. It is a merciful step. And he deals with this continuing underlying issue of Israel challenging divine authority. Again, at the end of chapter 16, we find Aaron being willing to stand between the dead and the living. And that should have been enough. That should have been convincing proof enough of Aaron's needed intercessory role. And yet here in this chapter, God will look to drive the final nail in the coffin of their opposition by supplying to them even more evidence of Aaron's unique role. Now, chapter 17 is similar to chapter 16 in that what we have here are successive days that are discussed. In chapter 16, we find three successive days. There is the rebellion. Moses says, come back to the tent of meeting on the following day, and they do that. And then on the following day after that, the congregation assembles and grumbles against Aaron and Moses. Here we find a very similar pattern in that it's going to be a two-day process as to what is revealed here. But even though there are some similarities, there are also very great differences. Because what motivates this is not like the previous chapters, and that is some kind of a complaint on the part of the nation of Israel that compels God to bring proof in the way of death and judgment. But now God is the one who is the initiator. God is the one who steps forward in an effort to prove the validity of Aaron's priesthood, but to do so not with judgment and death, but rather through peaceful means, through an emphasis on life. And it eventually results not in the complaints of the people, but rather in their cries for mercy. This is also going to be a very important point moving forward, especially when you consider Aaron's increasing age. He needs to establish beyond any shadow of a doubt the legitimate priestly line of Aaron, that it resided not just in the tribe of Levi, of which Korah was a member, but in particular, the sons of Aaron. Aaron, you remember, has two surviving sons, and it's going to be one of those two men, and a son after that, and a grandson after that, who one day will take the responsibilities that Aaron is fulfilling at this moment in time. And if Aaron himself experiences fierce and vocal objections to his own distinctive role while he is alive, what's going to happen when he dies? And it's his two sons, or one of his two sons, that are left to serve. And so with the death of Aaron, the nation could easily become embroiled in some renewed contention, some potential division as to who could legitimately serve as a priest. And therefore, it seems that God was looking to emphasize and to convince them from this point forward in regard, at least, to the priesthood. Now, there's going to be grumbling after this, but it doesn't seem to be a major issue in terms of the priesthood from here. Now, I hope your Bibles are open. Let's begin. There's four parts to the chapter. And it begins with God reaffirming his spokesman. Notice chapter 17, verse 1 and the first part of verse 2. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to the sons of Israel." The distinctive roles of both Moses and Aaron have been challenged in recent events. And understand that both of these men not only need some reconfirmation in the eyes of the nation, but need some personal reassurance as well. Aaron's role certainly has, as a priest, has certainly been authenticated in the previous chapter by his effective intercession. But now God looks to reassure Moses. He confirms to the people, look, Moses is still my spokesman. You may reject what he says, but understand that Moses is my mouthpiece. He conveys his message to the rebels that this guy who you may not want to listen to, that you may not want to accept, is the very instrument that I am going to speak through. The one you doubt, the one you despise, the one you reject is the one that I continue to choose. Aaron and Moses had differing roles, but the nation needed both of them. The sinful people of Israel needed a compassionate intercessor in the form of Aaron, and the ignorant people of Israel needed a persuasive prophet and teacher in the form of Moses. And yet, even though they continued to want to turn away from Moses' words, God still speaks through him. Picking up in verse 2 now, we find the second component of the story, and that is God reconfirming his decision. He said that Moses was to say to the sons of Israel, "Get from them a rod for each father's household, 12 rods from all their leaders according to their father's households. You shall write each name on his rod, and write Aaron's name on the rod of Levi, for there is one rod for the head of each of their father's households. You shall then deposit them in the tent of meeting in front of the testimony where I meet with you. It shall come about that the rod of the man whom I choose will sprout. Thus I will lessen upon myself the grumblings of the sons of Israel who are grumbling against you." Moses therefore spoke to the sons of Israel, and all their leaders gave him a rod apiece, for each leader according to their father's households, 12 rods, with the rod of Aaron among their rods. So Moses deposited the rods before the Lord in the tent of testimony. Now remember that at the end of the previous chapter, the people had just been given undeniable evidence of the validity of Aaron as God's representative. And yet it seems that the Lord understands that maybe not everyone was convinced of that. And so here we find, in a sense, a symbolic reenactment of the whole Korah thing, in which God is going to choose who is going to stand as his representative. He devises a way to settle the dispute of the priest's exclusive responsibilities. And he points this sign to those who perhaps were not won by the judgments that had transpired in chapter 16, but that perhaps they will instead be moved by the demonstration of mercy that he shows here. And so there will be two signs. There will be the bronze covering. You remember they were to take the censers of the 250 men that died in the fire. They were to take the bronze from those censers, hammer them out and form a covering to the altar of burnt offering. And thus there would be a reminder of them, of that rebellion, but also a reminder of death. Here, this sign will be a reminder that comes through the avenue of life. The head of each tribe is to bring a staff, a rod, to the tent of meeting. There's actually a play on words here because the same Hebrew word translates the word rod that translates the word tribe back in chapter 1 and verse 4 and a number of other passages here in the book of Numbers. It is a very appropriate test because the rods will determine the tribe that God is going to select. Each tribe is to bring forth one rod that has the name of the tribe written on it. Levi's rod or staff is to have the name Aaron written on it. Those staffs are then taken, they are by Moses, they are placed overnight in front of the ark that symbolized the throne of God, the place of divine communication. And that process alone would teach Israel some important lessons. That when a matter is under dispute, the place to bring it is before the Lord. That they are to seek His presence, to discern His will. But they must also do so desirous of submitting to His authority. They're not to depend on human ingenuity or human opinion, and they certainly are not to depend upon rebellion. The third part of the story is God reestablishing here His representative in the eyes of the people. Verse 8. Now, on the next day, Moses went into the tent of testimony, and behold, the rod of Aaron for the house of Levi had sprouted and put forth buds and produced blossoms, and it bore ripe almonds. Moses then brought out all the rods from the presence of the Lord to all the sons of Israel, and they looked, and each man took his rod. But the Lord said to Moses, put back the rod of Aaron before the testimony to be kept as a sign against the rebels, that you may put an end to their grumblings against me so that they will not die. Thus Moses did, just as the Lord had commanded him, so he did. Then the sons of Israel spoke to Moses, saying, behold, we perish. We are all dying. Everyone who comes near to the tabernacle of the Lord must die. Are we to perish completely? When those staffs or rods were put before the presence of the Lord, all of them had two things in common. One thing that they had in common was that all of them were dead pieces of wood. All of them had been severed from the source of life. Secondly, all of them were put into the presence of God. And yet, overnight, there is something dramatic that takes place. Over the course of a single night, the walking stick, if you will, of Aaron's buds and blossoms. In a sense, Aaron's rod is resurrected. It comes back to life. And by means of his position, or this act, his position will be affirmed over all of the other tribal leaders. There is now undeniable, visible evidence. There could be no doubt that this was an act of divine intervention. God, by means of his own sovereign choice, has caused one of those 12 sticks to come back to life. And if God could do that, then God certainly had the authority to select one tribe out of all of the tribes of Israel and one family out of that one tribe to be his representative, to be his unique servant. An interesting piece of information is that the Hebrew word blossoms there is the same word that's used to describe the golden plate, the golden diadem that was worn on the front of Aaron's high priestly turban, and inscribed on that were the words, holy to the Lord. And it's found in Exodus 28 and verse 36, chapter 39 and verse 30, and Leviticus chapter 8 and verse 9. But you'll notice that Aaron's rod doesn't just bud and doesn't just blossom, but that it bears fruit. And the fruit that it bore is also significant. The Hebrew word for almond is derived from a word whose verb form means to watch or to awake. To the Jews, they called the almond tree the watcher, the awake one, because it was one of the first ones to blossom in the spring before all of the other trees awoke from their slumber during the winter. Now, the image of the almond blossom, you'll remember, was also incorporated into the lampstand in the tabernacle in Exodus chapter 35. And the first vision that Jeremiah the prophet saw was a vision of the rod of an almond tree in Jeremiah 1 and verse 11. And it is that vision is then interpreted as meaning that God is going to watch over His word, the words that Jeremiah speaks, to perform it, Jeremiah 1 and verse 12. And so it's an image that communicates a great deal about the divinely appointed order of the priest. The close connection of God is captured in the name that the priests were to watch over the people by instructing them in the word of God. The moral purity entailed in the priests reflected in the white, beautiful flowers that blossomed on that rod. And the fruit that it bore reflected the spiritual fruitfulness that Aaron's priesthood would provide to the nation of Israel. As each of the 12 men came and retrieved their dead sticks, they saw the live staff of Aaron. And they should have concluded that the God who could do that with a dead piece of wood was a God to be reverenced and honored and never ignored and certainly not rebelled against. That what that God chose would be what I would need to submit to. Now, God instructs Moses to keep that rod as a sign, a continuing sign of God's authority. It will find a permanent place in the tabernacle. It will be preserved with those other two things that we mentioned earlier, the sign of God's unique authority, the tablets of stone with the law of God, and the sign of God's unfailing provision, the pot of manna. Those three things would find a home within the Ark of the Covenant. And you'll notice in verse 10 that God says that that budding, blossoming, fruitful staff was intended to forever put to an end the grumblings of the people against their chosen leaders. Aaron and the descendants that would come after him have been confirmed as being the representatives of Israel to God, of God to Israel, having the responsibility of instructing the people in the statutes of the Lord, that only Aaron and the tribe that he represented, Levi, could approach God. Only Aaron and his sons could make atonement for Israel's sin. And Israel as a nation needed to acknowledge their unique place. And anyone who did otherwise would die. And in verses 12 and 13, it seems that they finally understand what they're guilty of. The sudden earthquake that swallowed up the ringleaders, the fire in the previous chapter that had consumed 250 of their supporters, the judgment, the plague that had fallen and taken the lives of almost 15,000 people and sent them to an early grave. It seems that those kinds of things didn't do or didn't achieve what this one sign of mercy was able to achieve. Because at the end of the chapter, these people are panic-stricken that they might meet a very similar end. The tent that had been a place of peace and security for them is now appears to them to threaten their safety. And it seems they come to the realization that they need someone else to draw near to God, that they need someone else to make atonement for their sins, that they now finally recognize the priesthood of Aaron and his unique role within it. And then notice the first seven verses of chapter 18, because here we find God reiterating the distinctions, at least some of them, between the family of Aaron, who is a Levite, and the rest of the Levites as servants. Chapter 18, verse 1, so the Lord said to Aaron, you and your sons and your father's household will be with you, shall bear the guilt in connection with the sanctuary, and you and your sons with you shall bear the guilt in connection with your priesthood. But bring with you also your brothers, the tribe of Levi, the tribe of your father, that they may be joined with you and serve you while you and your sons with you are before the tent of testimony. And they shall thus attend to your obligation and the obligation of all the tent, but they shall not come near to the furnishings of the sanctuary and the altar, or both they and you will die. They shall be joined with you and attend to the obligations of the tent of meeting for all the service of the tent, but an outsider may not come near you. So you shall attend to the obligations of the sanctuary and the obligations of the altar so that there will no longer be wrath on the sons of Israel. Behold, I myself have taken your fellow Levites from among the sons of Israel. They are a gift to you, dedicated to the Lord to perform the service for the tent of meeting. But you and your sons with you shall attend to your priesthood for everything concerning the altar and inside the veil, and you are to perform your service. I am giving you the priesthood as a bestowed service, but the outsider who comes near shall be put to death. The rebellion of Korah and his colleagues hinged to a large extent on the differences between the priests and the Levites. And so after giving the sign and confirming the priesthood of Aaron, God moves forward and he gives very clear distinctions of the well-defined role so that there would be no misunderstanding in the future. But you'll notice that he's not just talking to the Levites, but he's also making it very clear to Aaron and his sons, the responsibilities that they carry. And if someone should get too close, then understand that it is not only them that will be put to death, but it is you who will die as well. That they were to guard the sanctuary. That if someone should venture too closely, not only would that person bear the consequences, but so would the priests, and so would their assistants. Three things, and then we'll wrap up our study tonight. One of the things that we see here is the fact that God is not disconnected from his people. Did you notice the purpose of this test in verse 5? Look at what he says here again. God says, It will come about that the rod of the man whom I choose will sprout. Thus I will lessen upon myself the grumblings of the son of Israel who are grumbling against you. Isn't that an interesting phrasing, way of putting it? Now, we understand that to grumble against God's appointed leaders is to grumble against God himself. But there's something more than that revealed here. It's God's point of emphasis that he himself is not detached from the problems of Aaron and Moses. And we find that going all the way back to the land of Egypt. Keep your place here and turn back to the book of Exodus. Look at the book of Exodus chapter 3. Look at the book of Exodus chapter 3, and let's begin our reading in verse 7. Exodus chapter 3, beginning in verse 7. The Lord says to Moses, I have surely seen the affliction of my people who are in Egypt, and have given heed to their cry because of their taskmasters, for I am aware of their sufferings. So I have come down to deliver them from the power of the Egyptians and to bring them up from that land to a good and spacious land, to a land flowing with milk and honey, to the place of the Canaanite and the Hittite and the Amorite and the Perizzite and the Hivite and the Jebusite. Then we find, now behold, the cries of the sons of Israel have come to me. Furthermore, I have seen the oppression with which the Egyptians are oppressing them. Isaiah 53 and verse 4, surely our griefs he himself bore and our sorrows he carried. Judges chapter 10 and verse 16, he could bear the misery of Israel no longer. That what this chapter reveals to us is that God isn't just aware of our trials and our heartaches, but that he feels them and that he feels them intensely. He cares about us and he cares about us deeply. I went and heard Russ Bowman in a meeting a couple of weeks ago, and he made a great point. He was looking at Psalm 51, and he made a very similar point. But the point that he made was that he illustrated it this way. The presidential candidates, they don't even know that we exist. And there's nothing that's going on in your life or my life that's going to have any influence whatsoever on those two individuals. But isn't it comforting to know that the God that we serve does know? But more than that, he's touched by it. He hurts. He cares about what is transpiring in not just our collective life, but my life as an individual and as yours. And we see that here. We see God taking an extra step, not just to convince the people of Israel, but to reassure Aaron of his position, of his authority, of his role, because he understood where Aaron was and the hardship and the burden that he carried. We see also from what we read in chapter 18, the value of supporting roles. Korah and his friends, what they found objectionable was the fact that, you know, the Levites were to assist Aaron and his sons as compliant servants. And they didn't like that. They wanted to be adventuresome initiators who charted their own course, who decided what they were going to do in their service to God. And yet they did that even though they themselves possessed a very privileged place. They were the ones who were charged with dismantling and moving by way of very careful transportation some of the most sacred objects in all of the camp of Israel. But the reality is that ministry in any form is a subservient activity. It's not an arrogant self-display. It is humble service by which the lives and the souls of other people are touched and are benefited and are enriched. And we see that emphasized to us by Paul in Ephesians chapter 4 and verses 7 through 13, where he talks about the various roles, apostles and prophets, evangelists and teachers, that are all to be working together for the benefit and the growth of the body of Christ. And then, of course, the glaring one that we see in this chapter is the challenge to divine authority. Because when you boil it all down, all of the events that we backed up and looked at leading up to this one have a constant. And that is an unwillingness on the part of the people to trust in God's instructions and to submit themselves to the ones that God has chosen. But what was certainly characteristic of Israel is still alive and well today, isn't it? Because ultimately, the root of all sin, the root of immorality and the cause of all religious division is a refusal to accept what God Himself has said, the choices that He has made, the stipulations that He has initiated in regard to what is the chosen instrument. What's the chosen instrument? The revelation of God is one of them, isn't it? That God has given us an instrument by which He has chosen to communicate to us His will that we are to follow. And yet many choose to disregard that. But He has also chosen His high priest. Look over to the book of Hebrews chapter 7. We'll close here. Hebrews chapter 7. God makes it very clear that not just in the Old Testament do we see Levi being the chosen high priest, but it is also emphasized to us in the New Testament that Jesus is His high priest. Hebrews chapter 7, beginning in verse 26, "For it was fitting for us to have such a high priest, holy, innocent, undefiled, separated from sinners and exalted above the heavens, who does not need daily, like those high priests, think Aaron and all the rest that followed after him, to offer up sacrifices first for his own sins, and then for the sins of the people, because this he did once for all when he offered up himself. For the law appoints men as high priests who are weak. But the word of the oath, which came after the law, appoints a son made perfect. Now the main point in what has been said is this: we have such a high priest who has taken a seat at the right hand of the throne of the majesty in the heavens, a minister in the sanctuary and in the true tabernacle, which the Lord pitched, not man." God is the only way to new life. And His instrument, His intercessor, His mediator, is the only way to come to Him. And the one that He has chosen is Jesus, His Son. And so tonight as we close, have you acknowledged the high priesthood of Jesus? Do you understand His role in being your representative before God, your advocate, your intercessor, your mediator? Are you willing to submit to His atonement that only He can provide, because He's the only one that God is going to accept? God accepts no one else. And there is this interesting parallel as well, in that Aaron's priesthood is proved by means of a resurrection of a stick. Jesus' high priesthood is proven also by way of a resurrection. Not of a stick, but of a body. As we talked about this morning, the importance of the resurrection, validating who Jesus was and what He came to do. Are you a participant in that? Is He your high priest? If not, there's no better time than now to make that decision. Can we help you to do that? I invite you to come. Won't you right now, while together we stand, sing.